Hello, I am Cody Ellingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. Today, I talk with Devon Lazell. Devon has a background in banking and finance. We talk about her Bitcoin story and what is important to her, including the proof of work of motherhood and exploring the best ways to enable children to learn and thrive in this changing world. Along the way, we also talk about architecture, modernity, and a little bit about what I am doing in my other life as a photographic artist. If you want to get in touch with me, please send an email to hello@thetransformationofvalue.com and I will get back to you. I do hope you enjoy this episode. If you would like to support the show, please consider streaming some Satoshis via your favorite podcasting 2.0 platform, such as Fountain or Breeze. Otherwise, onto the show. I'll start recording anyway, just so we've got, don't forget. I haven't forgotten so far to press the big red button, but it's always a possibility.
You've got a good set up there.
Yeah, no, it's great. I've got a studio here where I can do up to four people, actually. So.
Oh, that's good. Is that your art studio as well?
Yeah. So I'm sort of straddling two worlds, sort of Bitcoin and creative. But just had a big art show on the weekend, just at the TSB Arena. Yeah.
Yeah.
The NZ Art Show. So it was really good to talk to people about my photography and, sold a bit of work. So that was really good.
But
it's finding a sort of a sweet spot has been my journey over the last, I guess, year or so, where I can kind of bring my artwork and my Bitcoin interests and my philosophy interests and literature, all of it together. So it kind of makes sense, you know. So things like long-term thinking, proof of work, these kinds of things come through into the work itself.
Yeah.
Which is, it's been great to be able to integrate those together.
Yeah, I bet. What is your artwork primarily kind of focusing on at the moment, or what has it traditionally been?
Yeah, so I've always been interested in places. So I photograph a lot of houses, a lot of architecture. Mm-hmm. As you might remember, I lived overseas for many years, about 5-6 years in Japan, and photographed a lot of buildings, a lot of architecture. And it really, looking back, I feel like it's told that kind of economic story, that development story of kind of fiat, the kind of the tension between modernity and traditional values, all of these kinds of things. And I was sort of showing the form of that through these buildings, but now I've become very interested in the places we call home. So photographing houses and kind of dwellings and sort of trying to elicit that kind of nostalgia for these places. So it's been a bit of an ongoing journey. Certainly it's been great to have that outlet, and I do a lot of writing and that as well. So being able to sort of bring it all together has been really powerful.
Yeah, I think having multiple modalities or things that you're passionate about, are interested in, though, really do help the conversation. Because, you know, like, I think some people just being involved in, like, say, economics, for example, you're bringing one type of thought process. So, anyway, are we recording now? I'm not even sure if we are. Are we?
No, no, oh, yeah. This is good stuff, though.
But okay.
Sorry, yeah. Just pulling on that thread, though, Devon. Yeah. The idea of sort of pure logic and sort of, I think there is an engineering mind that goes into Bitcoin thinking, and that is sort of the predominant mode. But we found that talking, to people like Mike and Brad about engineering, you know, it's a very systems driven process. But if you look at the creative side, I think there is room for that still, and that different mode. And I think that's where I'm interested, you know, because living purely in the ideological garden of Bitcoin, you're sort of cutting yourself off from these other parts of the bigger picture, which is sort of this academy of ideas, which I was thinking about yesterday, actually. You know, like, well, what does a better society look like? What is, you know, human relations, politics, all of these things? How can they be mediated through a Bitcoin lens, but they're not limited to the systems of software or some sort of protocol, you know?
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. I was going to ask you about your art. Do you, I notice, you know, when they talk about proof of work or and architecture and all those kinds of things, like people are saying that architecture is starting to get sort of too simple and boring, you know, like you're going from that really elaborate architecture to the sort of boxy kind of modern look. Are you noticing that coming through in your art, or do you think you have appreciation for like all of it as an artist? Like, where are you going with that, I guess?
I think so my first major work was actually looking at the public housing apartments in Japan that were built after the war. And I think there is a bit of nuance to it because there is these criticisms of brutalist architecture, and they're clearly brutal concrete buildings, but there was something quite beautiful about them because they represented sort of a utopian dream. And so after the wooden towns and cities had all burnt down during the war in Japan, they kind of rebuilt with this concrete and this kind of new modernity. And in a way, that was like the high of the fiat, you know, like that was the hit. And they were able to rebuild and make all of this happen. And it was all sort of funded through, the intervention of the United States and sort of selecting and kind of anointing Japan as, a key geopolitical player post-war. And so Japan sort of benefited from that. But you can still see these buildings today because they've been immaculately maintained. And they're clearly not as beautiful as traditional houses, but in a way they're more versatile. They last longer. They're more safe to live in. And so I think there is nuance to it. Same with the UK. You know, they had the Blitz, which knocked down all of the old Victorian houses, and so they had to rebuild these sort of housing estates, which were kind of, quote unquote, ugly, but they actually weren't because they were better than having a pile of bricks that, that you couldn't live in. So you see what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, like, you know, bringing all these different, there's so much nuance, I think. And I do feel that sometimes in the Bitcoin space, it can get very like one way of thinking. And I think that's sort of the point of Bitcoin, isn't it? It's actually about new thinking, new ideas, and bringing all of this together. And you know, not don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think that's something that's important in these discussions personally. But I've always been like kind of a person that rebels no matter what. Whatever space I'm in, I'll rebel against the thinking anyway. So
No,
I apologize to anyone listening to this if it offends them.
that's cool. Well, look, I'd be keen to pull on that thread a bit and find out a little bit about your backstory. So, like, I guess, like, who you are, what you do, what are you even doing here? No, like,
Yeah, exactly. What am I doing here?
Like, what's brought us together today,
Yes,
Devon?
I have really asked myself that a few times. Okay, so me, I will start with sort of education. So I went to uni at 18, did pretty okay at school. Started to do a law degree, did my first year, and then I was like, "What the hell am I doing? This is not for me." I was always really passionate, actually, about history. It was a really big passion of mine from really young. And did I actually loved art history? I was top of art history at school, and I just absolutely loved all that. And then everyone said, "You know, if you're good at those subjects, you go become a lawyer." And I got to law school, and I couldn't stand it. I just was like, "This is not me. I don't really see this kind of going anywhere for me." And then that sort of other option was to become a teacher, which again wasn't really me. So I did my first year and I passed, but then I decided to leave that. I worked for a while and then I got Hodgkin's lymphoma. So it's like a cancer that's or it can be life-threatening, and it was in my case, I guess. So they found a like a 13-centimeter tumor in my chest. When I was 21, and I had to have chemo and radiation. So I guess from like a background perspective, that was sort of the first time I probably started to question a lot of things in a deep way, because if I there was just so many things I had questions about. And then, you know, I had to go through the medical system and how all that works, which was interesting. And then I got a job working for a bank. And then I progressed through that really quickly, and was assistant manager of a branch when I was only 24, like basically half running a branch there. I lived in Wellington. And then because I had been sick, I did have an issue with fertility, obviously, like that can be a problem. So luckily I'd been with my partner for since I was 18. I met him at university. So we decided to have children really young. And so we were sort of the first in our friend group to one of the first to have a baby. And then we went to Canada And I was actually a stay-at-home mum for like 7 years because it was really important to me. Another thing I love about Bitcoin is because I feel like it has brought back that appreciation for the work and the proof of work of motherhood. That was a really refreshing and quite a big shift for me in my life. I always felt a little bit that people look down a lot upon people that chose to stay home and look after their children. And it's something I really wanted to do. And so I really appreciated that about Bitcoin. That was probably one of the first things that really struck me. And then we moved home. In the meantime, I'd actually done a bit of property development. My parents are property developers. And so I'm quite into like real estate and things like that, as well as sort of the finance lens. Then when I came home, something that always really interested me was investments. So I got a job at an investment firm. While I was there, I did my financial advisor papers to become accredited financial advisor. And I found that really interesting. I absolutely loved it. And I was kind of thrown into that world of investments in New Zealand, share trading, retirement, just how all of that works. But then I guess right in the middle of all of that, because I love philosophy. Have read a bit of history. I basically what happened when I was there is a lot of people would start to ring up and question, what is Bitcoin? Can I buy some Bitcoin? All those kind of questions. And the status quo answer from everybody was, it's a Ponzi scheme. Just forget about it. It's a joke. It's nothing. And I would say, how do we know this? And I'd be like, it just is like that's it's just it's nothing. It's what's it backed by? Like, but just no thought whatsoever going into what is it first. Like, it's fine to say it's something's dumb or a Ponzi scheme, but there was absolutely no thought at all around what advice are you really giving people. So basically, me being me, I took it upon myself that I was going to find out what it was so that I could tell people why they shouldn't invest in Bitcoin. And then I fell down the rabbit hole. And now here I am today. So
Yeah.
I've
Wow.
left my job and basically I couldn't, it wasn't that I thought everything in that world was terrible at all. There's a lot of really good people in that space, but it's very hard to go and start recommending people invest in the current world, knowing what you know as a Bitcoiner. So there was just such a huge, is it cognitive dissonance, where
That's
you're
right.
having to say something and you can't, but you don't really believe it anymore.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. That's fascinating. So you had people ringing up asking about this, and they.
Well, it actually comes up a lot. Like if we would go and do talks at events with people wanting investment advice, one of the first questions we would always get is, what is Bitcoin? Always. Like if people are really interested.
I think it really does represent a challenge for people who are within that existing legacy financial system, because they kind of. You can't, not everyone can entertain the two modes at the same time. It takes a certain kind of mind. And so it's a lot more common to reject one or the other. And so you either, escape and you're fully into the Bitcoin world, or you kind of just have to reject Bitcoin and sort of turn your blinkers on and forget about it. And that's a lot more common, in my experience talking to people, that they don't. Let themselves see what it is the Bitcoin has to say or to show them. And it's not just finance, it's tech software people. There's just this dependence on the hand that feeds them, which is powered through fiat. And to look too closely is to threaten your own livelihood in some ways.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think that this is going to sound terrible, but I have thought a few times that life would have been easier if I just didn't look. Like it's sort of like you tell your kids not to look at things because they might be scared or whatever. Like you're sort of protecting them, and I don't know if I could go back. As much as I have all this hope for the world now, I can see the problems. it opens up so much more than just, you know, there's an alternative financial investment. It starts to, you know, as you know, make you question like everything, like food, pharmaceuticals, politics, education, war. And I think that then you have to kind of start to look at all of that stuff as well. And I mean, I'm not surrounded by Bitcoiners, and so I'm now still, I mean, it's everywhere. People are stuck in that old paradigm, and you're over here sort of seeing it all because you see where the money comes from and where it flows to. And regardless of whether or not you think Bitcoin is like sort of, you know, the big use case for it that we're all excited about, you still have to face up to it's, you know, what does Jeff Bezos call it? He says it's an ego death. And it's over and over and over.
It's a place you can stand from which you can see the place that you thought was everything. It's like you know, we're able to go into this Bitcoin mindset and look back on the existing system, and when you're in it and you're in the existing system, that seems like it's the be all end all. And I think that's probably the kind of sort of spiritual question almost that you've sort of, you mentioned you had some medical issues, and I think many people sort of perhaps can connect with that sort of experience where you've had a huge life change that's given you a new perspective, but then you've also got this other place that you can kind of put a name to it. You know, I think Bitcoin, you know, there's some software, there's some technology there, but it's actually a name for a bigger place that you can go to and look at the way the world is run and the political social relations between people, from that lens, you know, forgetting about the software for a moment. And I think that's really powerful. And there are you know, parallels to this, you know, like Plato's parable of the cave. Are you familiar with that? Yeah, so it's sort of this.
How do you think, like, what are you, how do you put a Bitcoin lens on that? I'm interested.
Okay, well, for people who don't know, so the parable of the cave is, you know, we're deep underground and we're in a cave, we're sort of chained up to some chairs and stuff, so we're facing the wall and there's a fire burning behind us, and there's some people who are doing like a puppet show in front of the fire, and all we can see because we're chained up is the shadows dancing on the wall, and we take that because that's all we've ever seen. We take that as being the reality, and because we can't see the people behind us who are, you know, doing the puppet show. And what sort of we can find from that is if you actually are able to break those chains, turn around, you can see the people who are doing the puppet show, but then you can also find the staircase that leads out, you know, out to the surface. It's a bit like that final scene of THX 1138, George Lucas's first film, where the guy kind of finally escapes the underground sci-fi city, and, you know, he climbs out and he's into the, you know, into the desert, into the raw daylight. And the idea is like you get into the daylight and it's very blinding, you know, it's almost so much because you've been in the darkness for so long. And then so when you go back down into the cave to help the others, you're actually, you know, your eyes haven't adjusted back to the dark light, and so you actually seem like you're a bit crazy. You can't see anything properly.
That's pretty much, I think, how I felt for the last 2 years, because this has only been like a 2 year journey for me so far. So I mean, by no means an expert, but I definitely have felt that. So that's a good analogy.
So that's the parable of the cave, and that's sort of the you know, towards the end of the Republic, and just kind of a way of, so I mean, it's a physical description of a, you know, of a process, but really what it is it's a mental process of sort of, you know, releasing yourself from those chains when you realize there isn't actually any chains. You're actually just sort of part of this mode. And you know, it's a very lonely place sometimes as well, because everyone is watching the shadows dancing on the wall, and the analogy is watching the Twitter feed perhaps, or watching television. As the analogy for what you're, you know, what is projected on the wall, which isn't really reality. It's a kind of an illusion, I guess, a magical illusion that seems real though, if you don't know what real is.
100%. And I think that is, you know, like, you know, in the Matrix, when he wakes up from, you know, the, I don't know, what was it, the state that he was in, when he's, it comes out and he realizes reality, that reality, whilst it's good to be in touch with reality. I think it's also you're sort of faced with reality. Like you can see what the problems are, and they do, I think they seem quite enormous. And then probably knowing, Bitcoin fixes everything. I mean, I don't know if that's 100% true, but Bitcoin fixes this. And then I think there's an impatience of, like we're watching it play out in real time. It's really exciting, but you're also like, hurry up. Like, I want this to be happening now. Like the solution and people to understand it. And, I went through that as well, where I felt like I wanted everybody to know and I had to tell them. And I was just quite a lot of pushback.
Yeah.
And sounded completely insane, basically. So,
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
we've both come back from the blinding light of the pure daylight, and we're come back into the cave. And especially working in fiat world, you bring that sort of craziness to it. And I think though something you mentioned just a little bit earlier on though was the proof of work of motherhood. I really like that because, I think it's certainly something that's really important to people. Oh, it's probably the most important thing ever. You have to have a mother, and you have to have that connection with, with your mother. And so, what we've seen, in recent decades is this move towards, both parents working, corporate, whatever, being unavailable for children, things like daycare, kindergarten being kind of de facto. You sort of, as soon as your kids are old enough, you palm them off to be looked after by some other institution. And so, I'd be keen to just talk a little bit more about that. So, like, what is proof of work of motherhood? What does that mean for you?
Yeah, I think I'm really passionate about this at my core. Like this is, it's probably not the most exciting topic for other people, but I do think for me as a female and a mother in the Bitcoin space, like going back to really valuing the work that women as mothers do for their children and viewing it probably as important, if not more important than the husbands that go off to work and are the CEOs and bring in all this money. I feel like for years it's been that, when I've told people that I was a stay-at-home mum, I just instantly get put in the dumb person category or the lazy person category. And you don't have ambitions. And I don't think that people have value though these days the skills that an intelligent, hardworking person can bring to motherhood and like what it will do for their children. And like I was out on the weekend and someone said, oh, I just couldn't be a stay-at-home mum. I just need way too much stimulation, like mental stimulation. And I mean I know that these are elements of motherhood that can be quite that are quite drudgerous, like you don't sleep and changing nappies and all of that. I'm not downplaying that, but I do feel that I was really ambitious when I was young and I was relatively intelligent, and I did feel that it was like you'd sold yourself out by staying home with your children and coming into the Bitcoin space. I don't know why that is per se, but I just felt suddenly like this kind of connection to raising the next generation of human beings is actually the most important work you can do, and it was
Yeah.
just yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah. That's really awesome. I guess I had an experience with my parents. Like, they were self-employed growing up, and so even though they worked hard, they were always available. And I have these memories, like even after school, my mum was able to pick us up. It wasn't like, oh, I finished work at 6 o'clock. It's like, no, she was there and available for us, and she was able to sort of very tactfully make it all work. I remember, she'd always be taking phone calls in the car and stuff, but she was available. And it wasn't, I was never exposed to that corporate, having a parent who was working for some big company, like it, or, working for someone else. So effectively it was a very, it was a small business. It was just a couple of, it was just my parents and a couple of employees, mostly just my parents though. And that was really quite powerful for me, and my dad as well. Like, we were
You would have had them available.
they were available, and what they were working for was also quite clear because, they ran tree business, so, pruning and tree removals and things. And so I saw it, the equipment, trucks, you know, the chainsaws, you know, it was all there. So it was very proof of work, you know, like you've either done the work or you haven't, you know, it's pretty clear. That,
yeah.
And, you know, the kind of the fruits of the labor, you know, it's like, yeah, we've cut down the tree, you know, it's an old hardwood tree. We're actually going to mill it and we've got some timber from it. You know, like there was kind of this very tactile nature to the work. Whereas coming home and it's like you've gone to the office, you've come back, like what have you actually done? Except spend time away from your family, you know? So, yeah, before all of that, I sort of was exposed, you know, before Bitcoin, I was exposed to a proof of work family and you know, parents of being available for me and my brother, yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, that's like my husband and I, like he's just started a business, which, again, I think the drive to do that was probably fueled by Bitcoin, some thinking around that, you know, entrepreneurship. And we've got a business and managing to make it work with a family, and it's life-changing. Like it really is that you can have it all when you do that. So when you have children, I highly recommend that you keep that up.
Yeah.
Keep that tradition.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm unemployable anyway, having been brought up in, you know, working for yourself, it's really hard to go back to you know, salary. And it's interesting in the Republic, you know, they talk about in ancient Greece sort of the different types of people that are in society. You know, you've got the merchants and the guardians of the city state and these kinds of different categories. And the way Plato talks about the wage earners, or Socrates talks about the wage earners, he's sort of it's almost like they're seen as a lower class. You know, most people historically were self-employed, they were chattels, as in, you know, serfs of a farm, you know, just working for someone else. But that was seen as quite a lower level thing. Whereas today, the idealization of it is like you're going to be a salary worker and, you know, just be all
that's
good.
That's the dream.
That's the dream. So we've almost done the psyop on what it means to be successful.
100%. Well, I do worry. I mean, I hope it's not going to be the case, but I do worry that entrepreneurship is slowly being kind of discouraged. And, you know, it's the dream to, you know, go to uni and get your sort of the standard job that's on offer and then earn your salary. And then you're like looking forward to this retirement and you just spend your whole life waiting for that. You know, that's the sort of standard that we're all sold. And I think that, you know, New Zealand especially could, you know, we had a lot of small businesses and lots of, like, we are a really hardworking society. People that came from the other side of the world, like from Britain, you know, with nothing and started everything from scratch. So we're kind of all born startup, you know, kind of people. So, you know, I hope that changes more where people are, you know, New Zealand creates policies that help more and more so with entrepreneurship and innovation, because I think that's the key to a flourishing society. I mean, not everybody should do it, but a lot of people should.
Well, I think also the definition of what self-employed means is maybe something people don't fully appreciate, because, you know, it's not really the tech bro making the thing. You know, it's like it can be a hairdresser, it can be a tradie, it can be anyone who's working for themselves, and their time is their time and they take ownership of it. And there's something for everyone when you think of it like that, you know. And again, historically, that's what society was. Mm-hmm. You've only really seen this, you know, these mega corps emerge, arguably sort of as the failure of nation states begins to happen. Mm-hmm. Like you've got these transnational, you know, Uber corporations that are just sucking up everything. And in a way, you know, having the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker in the in the town square, you know, they're all self-employed, you know. And that's kind of the ideal, I think, is those smaller medium businesses, which have got family values. They're not publicly listed, they're not you know, trying to be this mega thing.
Agree.
And that, as you're saying, New Zealand is built on that. You know, we've got about, five big companies? Everything else is small and medium. So I think coming back to those values and what that unlocks for, you know, lifestyle, you know, connections with the family, that sort of thing, is really important. And that's even like family values, you know, like what does a family business look like? Because that's really excites me, you know, having the kids involved. You know, I remember going out in the truck to help clean up and sweep up, you know, trees, you know, after you know, tree work was done growing up and stuff like that. And it was really quite formative for me to be part of that 100%. Process. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree. Like, I think now, you know, you've got the whole daycare thing. Like, I mean, people have to do what they've got to do. It's not really a judgment on them. I think it's just that, you know, if you have your children around you and they see you working and they're coming to work with you, like, you know, we need to normalize, you know. I think actually COVID, you know, the lockdowns actually did do that quite a lot. Like, I noticed a shift now. Like, if you're on a Skype call and one of your kids walks in, you know, no one really cares. In fact, everyone cracks up. And, you know, quite often we'll be on a call and we'll have one of the kids sitting on our knee. And, you know, like, kids are now, like, you know, need to be integrated more into, not into the workplace all the time, because that would be quite a big distraction. But I do think that there's an element of seeing your parents working and being involved in that in some way, like you helping with the sweeping and all of that. Like, that's all education, right? Education is not just sitting at a desk. It's learning about the world and how it works and how businesses are run and how the economy works. And there's so much that kids can learn from being a part of that.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the best education for you know, because if you look at I am critical, and again, you know, this is probably a bit rich coming from me, but you know, I am critical of the schooling system in New Zealand and sort of what's actually being taught in the curriculum. I feel like there's sort of some challenges there, but in terms of what you can learn, you know, from people who are operating at a professional level, the practical knowledge and just, you know, working alongside your parents and just sort of observing, the kids just soak that up, you know. And in a way, the stimulation from school is just not there anymore. And it's probably one of the slowest moving pieces, right, is what's happening with the schooling system, you know, and with, you know, things like Bitcoin and the emergence of AI technology, you know, other stuff that's just happening right now, hockey sticking, you know, to expect the curriculum to keep up with that is pretty wishful.
Yes. Well, one of the high schools here last week published something saying that there'll be serious disciplinary procedures against anybody that is caught using ChatGPT. And I just cracked up laughing because, like, whilst I agree, don't just, if they do the standard model of, like, write this essay, which is just the stock standard question, and then someone gets ChatGPT to write it for them, sure, no one's learning anything. But educators are going to have to start structuring learning around using that as a tool so that kids can, AI, you know, in its best case scenario, is actually an individual teacher for a child. You know, I know my daughter, she is really into science, and some of the stuff she's asking is really complex, and she wants to conduct these experiments, and the questions she wants to ask are really deep and quite high level, and they're very specific to her project and what she's trying to learn. And so we're like, please just go and ask ChatGPT, how you do all of this. Like, you know, ask it all the questions about nature and all these things that she can ask, and she gets a specific answer. And you don't actually have that. Like, where in life have kids ever had access to that before? Unless your father or mother is a science teacher, or, you know, like, we're talking quite, you know, her brain is ready for stuff that's quite beyond her year level. And I don't mean that because she's some sort of a genius. I mean, like, kids are really smart, and when they can ask something a question and get really good answers and learn how to ask those questions, she can't make up the results. So she still had to go and conduct the experiment and do all of the things, but she has learned so much and what kind of questions to be asking. And I think that that's the future of education, and that's where educators need to go. Like, let's get some great ideas out of these kids and teaching them things that meet them where they're at.
Yeah, that's a great point. And looking at the history of, you know, schools and just, you know, state-run schools in particular, I mean, they're a relatively new phenomenon. And the historically, you know, it was all about private tutors. You know, you had the uneducated masses, and then you had, you know, people who could afford to have a private tutor. And I mean, it's a far superior way of teaching, because you've got one-on-one attention, you've got tailored material for that child. It's you know, going at their speed. And the kind of, I don't know what class sizes are like these days, but is it like 30 kids to a classroom?
Yeah, even more, 30-35,
you know, and
one teacher.
Yeah, one teacher. They're all the same age, so they're not learning from each other, you know. So because I mean, there's some innovations which, again, you know, it's rich coming from me. I haven't got any kids at the moment, but like, thinking about it, you know, it's like, well, are we you know, how are we going to interface with that? Do we want to be part of that system? Because I mean, I was lucky to get through it. I think, you know, I managed, I thank my parents for it, because they sort of, you know, you learn most from them, I guess. But yes. If I didn't have that, where would I be? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. But I think, I mean, we're talking about it now and the problems with it, but I think there's a huge amount of change that's going to come in the next 10 years that are just going to happen. Like, the best schools will be the ones that utilize this technology to teach their children individually, and curriculum will become more individualized, what you're interested in, what your passions are, what are you good at. And it isn't just reserved to, you know, the five subjects that everyone agrees with. Like, if you're, you know, if you're really artistic, you'll be able to tailor education to you know, teach an artistic mind and delve into that. If that's what you're naturally good at and that's what you love and that's where, you know, your talents lie, I think that you'll see that more and more. And I just hope that schools and that pick up on that, so that we are starting to create more brilliant people that have actually delved into their own individuality and what they're good at, and create something beautiful out of that. I mean, imagine if every single human being could do that. Like we'd have like the Renaissance again, you know, like Renaissance 2.0. And I hope my children go down that. But I think that, again, going back into this whole, you know, about the entrepreneurs and the small businesses, I think that the problem these days, like, if you're really smart and talented, you end up going into a job like finance or accounting and law, and those, a lot of those jobs are really just compliance jobs now, like paper pushing, lots of regulation. So the education system is kind of set up, I think, to be that type of a person, like educating people to go into these desk jobs and tick the box and, you know, make sure that compliance is being followed and all that red tape. And it's an absolute behemoth in New Zealand now, and all these industries, like the building industry, the legal industry, the finance industry. Like, you're in your bank now and you're not dealing with a banker anymore. You're dealing with a compliance officer. All they're there to do is make sure that you're complying. So yeah, the type of jobs we've got now that pay well don't really bode well with, like, free thinking individuals that create something new. So that's the shift that I think we're going to see.
Yeah, I often, whenever I go back to Hawke's Bay, I, you know, maybe with my wife or whatnot, you know, I sometimes drive past my old high school, and I think of it, it was like I was almost institutionalized, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, it's very nostalgic. It's sort of this longing for this safe idea, safe place where it's like, you know, you have a schedule, you've got a timetable. You know, they even give the kids the little timetable of their subjects each day and the different periods that they're going through. And I remember back to that and I was like, man, that was so comfortable. It was like the blue pill, you know, you just mm-hmm. you just turn up, you just sort of nod mm-hmm. your head, you just sit in your chair and at the desk, and you're part of this organism, this institution, mm-hmm. And it's very comforting. And I think that it's just like, wow, that. But I remember at the time I couldn't wait to get out of there. And I'm so glad I did. You know, I broke out of that institutional thinking. But I think for a lot of people, you know, you go straight from that to university, to job, to working. And it's just a continuation of that mental model, and it's sort of compliance, mm-hmm. right? And there's no mm-hmm. room for deviation. And I mean, you get, you know, mm-hmm. was it problem children? I was probably one of them, but like, you know, that's like, well, why is this happening? You know, what is the underlying issue here? And I think there's room for discussion in this space. It's, you know, in the education system, you know, how do you work with different kinds of people? How do you get them to achieve their, you know, their personal excellence, and what does that look like for each child? Mm-hmm. It's idealistic, obviously, but like, I think having that as a goal.
Yes, but educating kids from a young age, right? Like, educating them, like, probably a bit hefty, but you're like, well, now, child, you need to discover your individuality and create something new, and, you know, let it bloom into the world, and, you know, you every single human should be doing this. But I do think in the past, that's kind of how education was viewed, whereas now we're like, everybody must, you know, it's very much like go a test, study hard, get the marks. But it's, you know, it's not really encouraging new things to be created. But there's an element as well, you have to, right? If you want to be an engineer, these days, you do really have to understand the principles of engineering. You can't just, there's an element of structure that is involved in learning the basics. But again, with like individualized learning, like, my daughter's learning to code. She can teach herself that now. Like, in my life, with having a new business, there's quite a lot of things that I don't know, obviously. And I don't feel panicked anymore. I'm like, I'm just going to go find out. I can just look this up. I can ask heaps of questions until I understand subjects that I knew nothing about. And it's phenomenal.
Yeah, I think though, in some of my other consulting work, I do engage with scientists, plant pathologists, and people working with biology and that sort of thing, and in terms of what they're researching, what they're understanding, and then turning that into models and digital tools. I do a bit of work in that space through my design business, and the scientists and really, top people, top of their field that I've met, I think in a way they all have this kind of creative, eccentric sort of behavior, which you only get at the very top end of a field. And so there's, I think, a broad middle spectrum of people who can get work done and they can follow instructions and reproduce, to specification. But then actual innovation at the cutting edge, everyone I've ever met who's doing that is at least a little bit creatively eccentric,
Yes.
and not I wouldn't say crazy, but they're pushing the limit.
Yeah.
And you can't, you can't push the limit without pushing your own personal limit.
Yes.
And so I think there's something in there where it's like, yeah, of course you need to understand deeply, fundamentally how things work, but you then also need to have that kind of chaotic, stochastic creativeness to also actually go to the next level.
I agree. And I think what Jordan Peterson said that the higher like you are on the creativity element of your personality, like it's usually the most intelligent. So yeah, is it an element of create, like, the most intelligent people are often the most creative. But I think that like society now is stifling a lot of creativity, and every single human being, I think, has an element of creativity in them, right? Like every single human being has something about them that they can create, and it doesn't have to be a piece of art. It can be cooking, it can be building a house, it can be studying a subject that you're really passionate and writing about it. So I think like maybe it's getting more back people finding what that is for them and having that outlet and encouraging it regularly, rather than like we said before, go to your desk job, go to uni, go to your desk job, pay your taxes and die. Like that's not, maybe that's a bit not pessimistic, but like I think that would be great if we encourage our children to think more like that, like be creative, be your individual self.
Yeah, I think there's also, we have many of the ingredients already available, but it's just a matter of sort of bringing them together. You have the Steiner schools, which I think can be quite successful, having children of different ages together. There's different ways. Montessori, I think, is the other system for schools. And, I'm just, at a distance looking at these different models for education and sort of what they offer, how children can learn from each other, as opposed to just having this sort of centralized teacher or centralized curriculum coming through these agents of the state. These teachers, bless their souls, they work hard, but they're basically, chained to the curriculum, almost every day, and that is sort of prescribed. And that's sort of coming through, but if you decentralize that, what does it look like to have, children kind of discovering stuff on their own with the kind of stewardship kaitiaki of, a teacher or a number of teachers with certain overlapping skill sets to help the kids kind of, find, because, teaching the children how to learn is really the important piece, and curiosity and thirst for knowledge, the rest of it, they can fill their brains up themselves, but if you give them that skill set, it really makes a big difference.
100%. Yeah, my children went to Montessori and
Oh, yeah.
when they were little, preschool in Canada. And one thing I loved about their philosophy is they believed that you should never dumb things down for children, introduce them to all ideas. So when they were like two, they would show them like a clock, with hands on it. And they would be like, this is a clock. And like, it's beyond a 2-year-old how to tell the time on a clock, really. Like they can look at a clock and they might know some concepts, but or weather systems and all these kinds of things. They would talk about it with the children because they're like, well, maybe they don't fully understand how to tell the time on a clock at 2. But when they're 5 and they're at school and time is being discussed, they would have already kind of in the back of their mind had it shown to them and explained to them, and that learning, like you can teach them these things at a little, at 2 years old, and then it makes the pathway for them down the line easy. And so they would introduce quite complex subjects to little children, so that when it came up down the line, they wouldn't, they sort of had this inkling, like, I think I know what this is. I've seen this before.
I think absolutely, the sort of baby shark iPad generation of children, and again, it's rich coming from me, but looking at that with, my cousins and stuff, it's like, yeah, I don't know about that, because I mean, I was really lucky. When I was growing up in that, I remember I was really into astronomy and looking at, I had these like really like detailed books on, galaxies and, the formation of stars and things, and I had a telescope, and I remember writing down all of the NGC, there's all these different galaxies and stuff you can see with a telescope. There's a list of them, the NGC list, and I remember going through and like ticking off all the ones I could see and drawing little sketches of it, and it's
That's
like,
awesome.
but that's like university level stuff almost. But you just kind
It
of
is,
work, you kind of work it out, and if you don't know, you go and find out.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got all the resources, and ChatGPT, as you say, or Wikipedia, or Google enable that. So you don't need to dumb it down.
No, not at all. Like, I think, like you said, like at that age, you were doing like university level, astronomy there. And that's the pro I guess you're right. Like, the problem with the education system is that, you've got just everyone's kind of getting, it's leveled out, but it's not lit. Like, there's certain subjects that some kids will be brilliant at, and they can't really be met at that level unless they have parents that are able to somehow afford or teach them things. So, yeah, I think that's probably what we'll see just naturally over the next 10 years. It's all going to change.
No, it's really exciting, and sort of unlocking that human potential, of a new world. I mean, I've been thinking about this a little bit. Actually, yesterday I was ha having a deep dive into really, I've had this idea for a little while, Devin, just kind of a space to bring people together. Like, I'm based in Wellington, and I've got a really good network here, but it's also feels sometimes like there's more that I could do to bring people together to have these ideas. And I'm sort of looking at, say, the university system or the old academy from ancient Greece, and sort of the idea of like a forum or a place where people can come together to discuss ideas and kind of connect. And in a way, I realized I had discovered Citadel theory for Bitcoin.
Oh,
But
really?
looking at
Is that Citadel theory? Is it
Yeah,
like
like having a place that you can building the thing that people can come to, and not just Bitcoin, but the art side. I've got a huge stack of books here next to me, and a library, and kind of like what would it mean to share that? Because the university up the road, Victoria University, doesn't do that anymore. It's a citadel of ignorance, sorry, like and to actually rebuild that, there's something really appealing to me about that. I'm not quite sure how to articulate it. Do you sort of know what I mean? Like,
I think I do. I think you're being a bit hard on yourself though, because like when we went to like the Vic Kiwi meetup, like you are bringing people together. Like, what is the role in the citadel of the person that does that? Do you know the name of the person that organizes all of the people together and brings them into the space? Like, have you looked at that?
I don't actually know like what my role is going to be in it, because at the same time, like, you can be a facilitator or you can be a doer, and the person actually helping make things. And I mean, maybe it's decentralized, maybe it's different overlapping people. You've got the BitKiwi guys doing their thing, and got the podcast where I'm able to bring people in here. But I guess the vibe that I was sort of riffing on was this. I spent a bit of time in Japan, and I went to university there for a year, and I just remember like turning up to the university, and you can smell the oil paints, and you can see the big empty classrooms, and you think, man, that your mind fills that space. You're like, wow, I've come from the countryside, and there's this amazing, place in the middle of Tokyo I can go to and make things happen. And in a way, like, I don't feel that anymore. Like, if I ever go up to the university here and visit, I don't feel like my mind. You know, it'd almost be like shrinking it to get to fit it through the door, you know, like, and sorry, I don't, you know, humbly speaking, but but the building itself, you can, you can make it, it's a beautiful space, but the thinking is very claustrophobic. Yeah.
I think that, again, it's just going back to regulation, though. Like, everything's just been so heavily regulated. Like, the way that everyone feels comfortable with everything is, like, as we regulate the education system, that we can mark off the teachers and we can make sure universities are teaching everyone the same thing. Its intentions were good, but, in, you know, when you go too far down one avenue, you get repercussions. And I hear what you're saying. It's like, how do we bring these ideas back? And, again, like, in New Zealand, I think we need this so badly. I think we need these spaces and we need these people. And I'm scared that New Zealand's going into a dark ages, you know, in terms of thinking. People don't see that. They're like, but is everything so great? And I'm like, it's just people don't see it. And I'm like, I've got children that are growing up in this country. I want to help bring that back myself. Like, I'll help you. You know, like, there'll be a bunch of people that will help you with that. And it's, everyone's hungry for it, but it's quite small here. You know, like, it's not like overseas where you see all these people come together and they have these meetups. I think here is desperate for that.
Yeah. Well, have you ever seen that film Dead Poets Society?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I look at that and I think of the magic of that. Obviously there's a bit of tragedy in there, but like that kind of magic and kind of that is what I think is missing in a lot of places, is that curiosity and that's thirst for knowledge and creating, you know, taking that kind of idea and having places like that is really important. But to your point around New Zealand, I got back from Japan about a week ago. I was doing a little holiday over there and catching up with people. Actually met with some Bitcoiners, which was really cool. But I came back through Auckland Airport and I was just shocked at how broken it was. There was literally holes in the wall. We waited for an hour and a half to get through customs and get our bags. And it was like, what is happening? It really felt so backwards. And I almost had to apologize to the people around me and say, hey guys, I'm really sorry. Like, it's not the way New Zealand actually is. It's just your first impression.
Yeah. I know. I agree. Like, it's sad. And, you know, Mike and I have talked about, like, in the long term, do we stay in New Zealand or do we go where there's places where people are, you know, we could go on about this forever, but, you know, we're all the ways that we can see that thinking needs to change, should we go to these places? And I'm like, but then should we stay here and create the future here? But it just does feel like there's a lot of pushback, because I do feel like so many people are like, oh, everything's great. And I'm like, it's changed so much, I think, in the last few years. Like, we used to be a really innovative country and it was beautiful, and it slowly feels like it is deteriorating. But then people are like, oh, you've gone really dark.
Yeah.
You've become really negative. And I'm like, well, how do you not see this stuff? Like, well, how do you look at this stuff and then do nothing about it? I don't mean them, I mean myself. Like, if I feel that way, am I supposed to just turn a blind eye and go, no, everything's great?
Yeah, well, I think we're trying to build the solution. We're trying to make things better, but at the same time, we're fighting a systematic sort of trend. And, you know, I look at New Zealand and, you know, I think compared to Japan, anywhere can sort of seem a bit backwards. But, I look at the infrastructure we have here and I think, man, we can't even build a train. You know, a single train line, and Japan has, you know, hundreds, thousands of train stations, you know, all of this infrastructure, all of these subways and factories and just perfectly aligned stuff. And I mean, they've got their own challenges, but, you know, if everything just stopped working, they would still have roads and highways and trains to kind of help them start again. But with New Zealand, it's like, yeah, we've got 80K roads a train line that is wonky at best, and you know, that's about it. And it's like we're still trying to think that we're a rich country and that we deserve to have things for free and that we don't have to pay for them and that we don't have to work hard. And I think there's something quite insidious about that kind of thinking, where it's like, yeah, we've got a lot of work to do. There's a lot of building that needs to happen, and I know people working in the energy sector, you know, even what Mike's working on. There's pockets emerging of excellence, but it's also like the overwhelming move is towards just letting things be, and to decay.
Yes, I did hear Peter Thiel was talking, and he did say that he's noticing with the, I guess we are more like a left-wing political country at the moment, and there is this kind of thinking right now in that space of not really wanting innovation. That innovation is seen as a threat, and the kind of thing, you know, like for example, they look at AI and they're like, shut it down, like get rid of it, like we need to put brakes on this. And whilst I do agree that there's definitely going to be some problems that come with that, shutting down innovation and thinking isn't the answer to like just let's go backwards or let's just stop it. And I do think that New Zealand has kind of got into that space. Like, you know, another thing I was thinking when we were talking is a lot of New Zealanders don't aren't particularly schooled up on philosophy or history. Like in your Citadel, what did you call it? Citadel theory, or anyway, in this group, like, you know, I was really into, I am into those subjects. And, you know, I was, when we went, I went to university, people were laughing at philosophy students and art students saying, you know, a monkey can do an arts degree, which is, you know, history and philosophy in literature. And it was, and I mean, they're engineers, so of course they're going to ridicule people that are interested in that. But it really is shunned now, like this whole, like we need to bring that back, because people now aren't, they don't realize how history has played out in the past and how New Zealand, you know, from where I stand, it has gone backwards in its thinking and its innovation. And people are like, no, everything keeps moving forward and getting better. And I'm like, no, look at history, like over and over again, you know, empires have crumbled because they got too complacent.
Well, I think my take on it would be, I studied, liberal subjects at university, and the real challenge, and I remember quite clearly on, one of the first days, as an undergraduate, the professor saying, by the end of this degree, you will all be Marxists. And I remember him saying that, and I had to deprogram myself effectively. So it was really great. I was able to sort of dip my feet into that world. And it was really great to learn about, culture studies, the things like the Frankfurt School of Culture Studies and these kind of ideas, which, there's a lot in that around how the culture is mediated by technology and a whole swathe of topics that I've been able to integrate into my work. But at the same time, I see, and I saw how it effectively, breaks people, and they go through 3 4 years of that. And they come out, just basically these zombies who are really only qualified to be tutors for the next generation
Yeah.
of culture studies.
Yes.
Um,
Yes.
and so I was able to temper that with, some other things I was doing. And it was very practical. I also studied languages, so it was like learning how to speak a language and some of that stuff. But certainly I think that the criticism is from that kind of postmodern, kind of nihilistic sort of side.
Yes.
But still, generally, just learning about art, about history, about philosophy, and all of that, kind of thirst for knowledge, is what the university is supposed to be about. And I think that has also been kind of hijacked. And that's sort of where, I was listening to Balaji recently talk about a little bit about, the United States and sort of these competing tribes. And it's in a way like the building, the framework from that it lives within, the form of the university has stayed static, but the contents have changed quite drastically. And I think that's probably where the criticism comes from, and even just yesterday I was having a chat with a young woman, who, I guess was looking at quitting university, and she was saying how, it was really hard for her, the end of high school with the lockdowns, and how that really affected her ability to study and her motivation, and now she's sort of regretting university. And I think, well, what can I say to her? Like, look, you just need to get the degree. It doesn't actually matter. You don't need it, but you do need it. You know what I mean? Like,
It's a tough one. I agree with you on that.
And trying to provide a bit of mentorship on that, but it was also like, well, I can't lie to you. It's actually a waste of time. But you do need it if you ever want to leave this country, because you need a degree to get a visa in another place. So it's sort of like, where do you go?
I know. I hope for my children when they are at that point, first of all, I want them to do what's best for them, and I won't be telling them not to go to university or to go to university. But, you know, I'll also be encouraging them to look at trades if that's what their skill set seems to trend towards. And also, like, bringing back that kind of like the apprenticeship, or I don't know what the, oh, what's the kind of like classic, what was the name, you know, when you worked under somebody and they mentored you, and you know, you you learned from somebody that was an expert in their field, and maybe you did it for free or you did it at a really low cost to
Yeah, or
them.
like I've been an understudy or an apprentice, yeah. Yeah.
An apprentice, really. And I think it would be great to see more fields start to introduce that, because it would help them. They'd have the help. And if you're working with a expert, then that's amazing. And then maybe do the study later on, like find out where your gaps are. Like I've studied later on, and I think, I was able to understand myself more and where my gaps were. I think it's really hard at 18 to decide what you're going to be doing for the rest of your life. And yes, the degree doesn't necessarily mean that, but I don't
Yeah.
know. I just think, yeah, it's a big decision.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think that probably the two examples I've got are this young woman who I was just trying to give a bit of feedback on around university, and then there's another young guy, a young photographer who I've been, I guess, talking to. I wouldn't go so far as to call myself a mentor to him, but I sort of was saying that, look, that this is what's possible. I've been in your shoes before, and this is where you can go. And I think similar to what you said before around, you teach a 2-year-old about time. They might not understand it, but when they're 5, they're going to pick up on that map that you've drawn for them. In a way, when someone's 18, they're still a child, and they're learning about, what is the future possible for them. What's 10 years look like? Because from the age of 8 to 18, it's a huge change. From 18 to 28 or to 30, it's also a huge change. But it's like less a physical change of your body, but more so what your mind is capable of and what you're able to do. And so, saying to someone who's 18, "Hey, look. If you just do this, this is where you could be," and kind of show them the path, and then they got to work it out. But it's like you don't have to be on the same trajectory that you're on. There's actually another whole way you can take it, and I think that's what's really important. And you don't get that in a university where it's worse than school, because you've got 300 students to a professor, and you got to book in a 10-minute slot to go and chat with the professor once a term. I think there's actually less mentorship there. And so the role of the Citadel or the Academy is actually to bring that back. And at the moment, it's informal for me. I just met these people through jujitsu and other things, but it's like, hey, give it a go. This is what's possible.
Well, that's the thing. Like, if you had this sort of community, you might bring in the younger people, the 18-year-olds, and then you've got the older and wiser folk that can, pair people up to find their mentor. And it doesn't even have to be in education or a career. It could be in, motherhood, fatherhood, art as a hobby. There's so many things. But I mean, everything, that listening to your podcast, like, it is getting back to that community, local food, more personalized education that's based on the real world, and people meeting other people and getting a community back again, right? Like,
Yeah, get our community back, proof of work of motherhood, and building a better way. This has been really interesting, Devin. I must admit, it's a super fascinating topic, and I think it's really great to hear your perspective on it as well. And I think, as you say, it's not just a singular way of looking at Bitcoin. It's actually a vehicle for asking a lot of different kinds of questions. Bitcoin is really just, it was just the beginning. It's the place that we can stand to look back on the rest of it. So, thank you for all of your input and your thoughts on this.
Well, thanks for having me.
No,
It
you're welcome. So
was
yeah,
great.
we might wrap it there. In terms of what you're doing, is there anything that you want to link people to? Anything you want to share? If people do want to reach out, or
No, I tend to sort of, I am online, but I'm online as pseudonymously, so I feel like I can say what I want to say without not that I would say anything too hectic, but I definitely try and keep my online presence kind of private. It's even been a big step coming like face to face on this, just because I don't want to be censored by what I say, worrying about what other people will think. So yeah, I am on Facebook and LinkedIn and all that though, so people
yeah,
can
sure.
find me if they want.
And if anyone wants to perhaps pass a message on, they're more than free to reach out to me as well, and I can sort of link you guys up. So no problem there. But hey, look, I really appreciate your time. We've covered some really interesting topics, and I hope we can catch up again in the future.
Yes, great. Thank you so much, Cody. It was awesome.
All right, thanks, Devin. See ya.
Bye.